This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Welcome, everyone, to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Over the last couple of weeks, we've covered a number of issues relating to the future market's direction and the economy. Last week, we talked about the bond market versus the stock market, how both are diverging, telling a different story as to which is more probable, either a recession or an economic extension and a continuation of the bull market. Well, we continue that story today with more facts, and we let you decide for yourself as to the body of evidence. And as we discussed last week, the Fed has done a major pivot, a turnaround from the hawkish stance that it was taking last quarter. And on Wednesday of this week, the government reported GDP figures. Now listen to these numbers. The trend is down again, and the best estimates for Q1 of this year show it will be down even further. We hit 4.2% in Q2 last year, 3.4% in Q3, and 2.2% in Q4. So unfortunately, the trend is heading south, with many, even the most optimistic economists, are predicting that it'll be even lower, closer to 1% for Q1 of this year. So the question at hand is, are we heading toward a recession? And could that be the real reason the Fed has stopped and reversed course from their planned rate hikes this year? Just as we covered last week, the Fed has come to a screeching halt. Now, before we get into the weeds here, I do want to bring up something that we covered in our second show of the year in our annual forecast show. At that time, Jim, you listed three major risks. The first one was a major policy mistake by the Fed. The second, a trade war with China. And the third that you listed was political discord. And by the way, we've seen what has happened with the Mueller report. If that's not discord, I don't know what is. So where do we stand today in terms of those three major risks?
You know, as we've been talking over the last, well, actually since the beginning of the year when the Fed did a about face, that risk, Chris, has lessened. But as some feel, and I would include myself in that camp, they may have gone one rate hike too far last December. And even though they're going to wind down QT, that's not going to happen until October. So we've seen the Fed do two forms of tightening, and they're still doing one form right now, raising interest rates and reducing liquidity through QT. Now, that's something they haven't done since World War II, so that might be, let's say, as some say, a bridge too far. And remember, we had Danielle DiMartino Booth on our show, and she used to work at the Fed, and she talked about it takes 18 to 24 months. There's sort of a lag between when the Fed raises interest rates. So, you know, as we look at where we are today, we really will not know the full extent of the damage, maybe till the end of the year. And it was something, Chris, I want you to play that clip in my recent interview with Danielle DiMartino Booth. When I asked her, I said, what is it? These guys are supposed to be the smartest guys in the room. They all have PhDs from Princeton, Harvard, MIT. What is it that 11 out of the 12 last recessions have brought about by Fed rate hikes? They always seem to crash the airplane. Let's play that clip.
The first lesson that I learned on day one at the Fed is that monetary policy acts with a lag of 9 to 24 months. So you should be aware that from the first time you raise interest rates, there's going to be a lagged effect before they have the stunting effect on the economy.
So, Chris, there is a lag effect, and that's a problem. If you think about it, the Fed starts raising interest rates. What happens? The prime lending rate goes up. If you have a adjustable rate mortgage, you could see rates go up on that mortgage. Your credit card interest starts to go up. Eventually, rates start to climb and mortgage rates start to go up, which is certainly what we saw last year when in the fall, by the time we got to October, we saw mortgage rates at close to 5%. But the fact that they aren't raising rates and are winding down QT certainly makes things better and lessens some of this risk. Now, right now, we've got long-term treasuries, which continue to fall with yields dropping below 2.4%. So the bond market continues to forecast a slowdown. Now, as far as the trade war is concerned, I expect that to get resolved by late spring or early summer. If it doesn't, we are definitely going to be heading for trouble. And finally, political discord. Well, we've seen that all year, beginning of the year, from the government shutdown. And over the last 2 years, everything was going to be the Mueller report, and that was going to be grounds for impeaching the president. Well, with the Mueller report out last Friday, the biggest risk was the possibility of collusion, which would have led to possible impeachment. That risk has been removed. So all we will have will be endless investigations, but nothing really done over the rest of this year and next year. So in many ways, the market sort of likes that. That's called gridlock. That could in many ways be a good thing.
Well, and hopefully it will pan out as something good. And speaking of good, Jim, let's go ahead and begin with many of the things that can go right. For example, you interviewed Ryan Sweet at Moody's recently. He felt the economy would slow down, but no recession. You also interviewed Jim Paulson this week, and he does not see a recession. So even though the numbers for the economy are trending down, they do remain positive. No recession this year. And by the way, Dave Rosenberg, whom Chris Sheridan interviewed on FS Insider this week, he said that there is an 85% chance of a recession by the end of the year.
The aha moment I had that really ratified my recession call, okay, I'm not saying it's 100%, I'll call it 85%. Those odds are pretty high. This is a high conviction call, was the Fed Loan Officer Survey for the first quarter. The Fed Loan Officer Survey for the first quarter showed, A, the banks tightening credit standards across every line of business. But what caught my eye was that whether it was commercial real estate loans, commercial and industrial loans, credit card loans, residential mortgages or auto loans, the demand for credit across the board was either slowing or contracting. So I think we're going into the early stages, and it's not going to be anything like 08 or 09, don't get me wrong. But I think after this monumental debt cycle that we've had, especially in the corporate sector, we're going into the other side of that. And that the theme this year and probably into next year is going to be one of debt deleveraging.
There's Dave Rosenberg predicting probably about an 85% chance of a recession. He's kind of one of those individuals that kind of gets ahead of the space and tends to think outside the box, so he's pretty credible. And he's talking about a number of reasons, some of the things that we have cited here on the program. But before we get to, let's say, what may go wrong and the recession possibilities later on in the year, I want to give you the positives with the first, which is the Fed pivot. That removes some of the big risks. The other aspect is bond yields have fallen by almost 90 basis points. And you think about that, almost a full percentage point. And if you really think about that, I mean, the Fed raised the Fed funds rate 4 times last year, so that's 100 basis points. We just dropped 90 basis points from where we were late in October. The other aspect is bond yields have fallen by as much as almost a full percentage point, and we're seeing a little bit of an inversion, which I'll get to. But that does a number of things. By interest rates falling, it lowers mortgage rates, which helps the housing markets. 30-year fixed-rate mortgages are down to around 4.2%. We saw this week pending home sales jumped up, and that compares to where we were last fall when we were down at or up at near 5%. It also helps the new car market. It's easier to finance or lease a car when rates are lower. A bigger area, and this is probably more important, the lower rates help the junk and the triple B market. This enables these companies, a lot of them in the energy business, to refinance their debt at lower levels. And as we talked about with my guest in the first hour on Saudi America, a lot of what's going on in the fracking world and a lot of shale plays, a lot of that has to do with the low interest rates that came about as a result of the last recession. So that could help avoid a blowout in spreads and a possible financial crisis in the corporate debt markets. Now, credit fuels this economy, and as long as the credit markets are functioning and credit is flowing, that's a positive. But in that interview with Chris Sheridan, Dave Rosenberg is watching credit, and it's beginning to slow down. So that is one worrisome aspect. But certainly, a drop in yields that we've seen lately, that's a big help to the market. Now, the second aspect is there's still plenty of stimulus left in the pipeline, and that money is going to get spent from now until the end of September when the government's fiscal year ends. Most of all that money is going to be spent, and that should be enough money spent or stimulus in the pipeline to keep the economy humming at least, I would say, to late fall. But I doubt, Chris, if the two parties can agree on any new stimulus package ahead of a presidential election. I mean, one of the best things that could happen to the Democrats is for the economy to go into a recession and a major bear market in stocks, pretty much the way Barack Obama was swept into office in 2008 during a financial crisis. So this stimulus that remains in the pipeline, and also don't forget, we still have those tax cuts. They're still in place. Corporations are paying a 21% tax rate instead of a 35%, which brings me to the next positive possibility, as some economists are talking about, is CapEx spending by business. Now, what is needed here is business confidence to improve now that rate hikes are out of the way. Because, I mean, you think about it. You're a business. You're thinking about building a new factory. You're thinking about hiring new workers or opening an overseas office. And your economist is going to you and saying, the Fed is raising interest rates, and you know what that means. You're probably holding back. And I think a lot of money was held back from spending as a result of those rising rates, because a lot of times some of these projects, whether it's a merger, it's a build out, or whatever it's doing, a lot of it is financed with debt. And if the cost of debt is going up, well, you're going to pull back. The project doesn't look as promising. CapEx spending, more than anything else, has broad economic gains when it's done with the roll-on effects with the rest of the economy. Now, let's talk about consumers. Consumer confidence has been trending down since last October, but recently it ticked up in February and then fell again in March. I think much of that downtrend probably has a lot to do with the stock market. Tax receipts are going to be down this year. A lot of that was done as a result of payroll withholding that went into effect in February of last year. And finally, and this could be the big one in terms of a short-term catalyst, and I would say more of an impact overseas, and that's the trade war with China. The trade war is definitely hurting global trade and Western and Asian economies more so than, let's say, here in the U.S. The U.S. is more of a self-contained economy. Exports make up less of our economy compared to, let's say, Europe, Germany, France, or even Japan and Asia. Here's the one negative. The principal trading partner with the U.S. is not Asia, it's Europe. So any stimulus or, let's say, a pickup in trade helps Europe, that helps us as well. So the removal of a trade conflict could bring down global anxiety and help to boost business confidence. So, Chris, those are the positives.
And quite a number of those are things we can really look forward to. And I want to summarize those things that can go right. The first one, interest rates are heading down. That helps housing. It also helps autos and even companies, helps them to refinance their debt. The second one is the Fed has gone on hiatus, so that should remove any possible policy mistakes. The third is that there's still a large amount of stimulus in government spending. That's still left to hold this economy up until the fall. Number four, consumer spending and business spending, it's still positive. Just a note here, by the way, that pending housing sales picked up last month. That reflects lower mortgage rates. And finally, a positive resolution to the trade war between the U.S. and China. Now, in summarizing all the positives, Jim, what are the negatives?
Time to head in the bunker, Chris.
I'm glad I packed.
Okay. Well, you know, we've talked about it here. If you take a look at the leading economic indicators, they're trending down. If you look at, for example, the ISM Manufacturing Index, it peaked in August. It has generally been trending down. Now, the ISM Servicing Index was trending down, but it recently ticked back up to higher levels and is holding up much better. The Conference Board's index had a slight uptick in February after being flat in January, but it was negative in December and October. So the slowdown that we're seeing in LEIs is also being reflected in the GDP numbers that you cited at the beginning of this segment. I mean, Q1 is expected to come in, Chris, somewhere around the 1% range. Now, a lot of people are going to say, well, you're going to have to kick this out because we had the government shutdown for 6 weeks. That was subtracting 0.1% for every week of the shutdown. So you multiply that times 6 weeks. So, you know, we're going to get below that 2% level. But the question is, does this trend continue into the second quarter? Now, if you look at what we have seen in this economic recovery, and I don't think I've seen anything like this, at least in my business career, typically you get the strongest quarter of the year. In the second quarter, the third quarter, things begin to slow down in the fourth quarter and the first quarter. So the LEI should give us a clue in terms of the economy, it should, especially given the government shutdown, it should get better in the second quarter, which is usually the strongest quarter of the year. Now, if it doesn't pick up, or doesn't pick up enough, or even worse, heads even lower, then look for the Fed to start talking about cutting interest rates. It's rather interesting. I looked at the futures market before we went on the air. It is forecasting a 30% chance of a rate cut by June. Now, everybody's thinking, oh, if they do, it'll come at the end of the year. That's not what the futures market is betting on. They're saying a 30% chance by June, 34% by July, 43% by September, and a 25% chance of two rate cuts by December. So the futures market is not only saying they are done, but there's a high probability here of cuts coming as soon as this summer. And if that being the case, we have to watch credit spreads, especially in the corporate bond market, because if it looks like the economy continues to slow down and it continues into the second quarter, what's going to happen? If you're in triple B or junk rated bonds, bond investors start discounting, selling bonds, driving prices down, because what happens? The risk level starts to go up. There's risk of a recession. There's risk of defaults. Credit spreads start to widen. Companies are going to have more difficulty rolling over their debt. So that would be one thing we would be keeping a close eye on. So we need to follow what companies say. Next week, we will be into the third quarter, or the second quarter, and we get into full-blown corporate earnings season. Now, what does that mean for the stock market? Number one, if you're a company and you have a stock buyback program, you go into a blackout period. It means you have to stop buying your stock. And a lot of people said that was probably some of the trouble that we saw at the beginning of the year. Now, that starts in just a couple of weeks. But what's going to be important in Q1 earnings? They're expected to be lower. And also, you got to remember, the year-over-year comparisons in this first quarter are going to be much, much lower than where they were last year when the tax cuts came in. When you cut tax rates from 35% to 21%, we saw an increase in earnings at 25%. You're not going to see that this year. Those tax cuts have already been in place, so year-over-year comparisons are going to be tougher. But more importantly, what companies are telling us about their business going forward. So analysts are going to be looking for guidance, because as you pointed out at the beginning of the broadcast, with economic numbers slowing since the end of the second quarter last year, if that trend continues, it would only be logical to be seeing that reflected in corporate earnings.
So Jim, if you were to side with the stock market or the bond market, outside of the things that you just mentioned, which side would you fall on?
You know, I tend to place more reliability on the bond market. We are inverting as we speak, with 3-month T-bills higher than the Treasury 2s, 5s, and 10s. So, Chris, we've inverted. And as Dave Nowakowski and I were talking about, now Dave thinks that's only temporary. I'm not so sure yet. Whether this is temporary or not remains to be seen. We'll see going forward. But an inverted yield curve has been a reliable predictor of past recessions. So right now, this isn't looking real good. And I'm trying to remain positive. And one of the reasons we wanted to cover some of the positive things is there's been a lot of bearishness out there. And we've been citing some of those things. We're in the cautious stance, but it's always good to read the other side of the story and look at what are the positives, because you don't want to be so bearish. But, you know, that's why we're almost hedging where we are right now. We're more on the cautious side of playing things, because I don't think we're out of the woods yet. And we don't know if we're, you know, basically we've got a brush fire that can turn into a conflagration. We don't know that. So we're trying to remain positive. But let's put it this way. This has been one of the most unreliable and most unconventional recoveries I've seen in my entire career.
Well, it's interesting you say that, Jim. That was one of the comments made by Jim Paulson in your interview with him on FS Insider this week. I'd like to play that now.
We've been arguably through the weirdest recovery ever in post-war history in the United States. There's nothing about this recovery that's normal, traditional. including the fact that the growth rate of the recovery has been abnormally sluggish throughout, the slowest recovery ever recorded. But also, as a result of that, look at the bizarre policy responses we've had, everything from TARP to cash for clunkers to quantitative easing to a fiscal tax cut at full employment. Just bizarre occurrences. It took forever to restore confidence. We've climbed a perpetual wall of worry during the first 5 years of this bull market. Even though it was strong, it was led by all the defensive stocks like dividend aristocrats and low-vol investors. It's been just so weird.
So he points out just how weird it's been. But given that weirdness, given that uncertainty, what do you think investors should do at this time?
You know, once again, Chris, we are defensive. We own short-term sovereign debt, which I think you should be owning. We own high dividend-paying stocks and also beaten-down value plays and a small position in gold and copper. So we haven't really changed that position since the beginning of the year. We remain on the defensive side of things, and we can't see a reason to change that right now. You know, once again, the verdict isn't out which way this is going to swing. Could the Fed possibly engineer a soft landing in the way they did in 1994 and 95. Now, we had Dave Nikoski in the first hour said that he thinks the markets and what we've seen recently is a lot like 1994 when the Fed doubled the Fed funds rate from 3 to 6%. And if you look at what Powell did last year by raising interest rates four times, a full percentage point, he basically almost doubled the federal funds rate. Now, granted, it's from a lower level. So we just simply don't know right now, and that's why I say you have to be defensive. And once again, the stock market isn't very cheap. I mean, if this was 2011, when we saw a 20% correction during the summer of that year, if this was, let's say, the fall of 2015, when we saw huge sell-offs in August and September over the China scare, if this was the beginning of 2016, when we saw the markets drop 6 weeks in a row, stocks were cheap. They're not in a bubble state. They're not extremely expensive, but they're not cheap.
Well, let's sum up, because we've looked at a number of things. Let's go ahead and tie this up. I've mentioned the positives, and just a brief review. We talked about interest rates are heading down, the Fed's on pause, there is stimulus left in the pipeline. I mentioned that consumer spending and business spending is still strong, and a possible resolution of the trade war between China and the U.S. Those are very positive things. But you just mentioned some of the negatives. You mentioned that LEIs are heading south, GDP is in a downtrend and it's getting slower. Profit margins are coming down as wages rise. And then the Fed is still winding down QT. And that last one you mentioned that a lot of people look carefully at is that the yield curve has indeed inverted. So given the body of evidence, Jim, I heard you say that you remain defensively positioned.
You know, Chris, that's the way we're playing it for ourselves and our clients.
All right. Well, in looking at everything that's happened and is happening, what do you see coming up in the weeks ahead?
You know, coming up in the weeks ahead, we are going to get a print on first quarter GDP. I suspect that's going to be closer to 1%. That's not going to be good. But also, we'll be getting more economic indicators. But more importantly, we're going to see if this economic slowdown is translated into a slowdown in corporate profits. You've got wages rising, which is cutting into profit margins. You had the dollar strong in the first quarter, based on the fact that everybody was believing the Fed was going to raise interest rates. Even though they went on pause, they were still hinting, hey, you know, we could have another rate hike or so. Well, that's all changed. So what we're going to focus on now is corporate earnings. That's coming up in the month of April, and what companies are saying about Q2.
And coming up next, hedging your bets, gold and hard currencies, in part two of The Big Picture.
Volatility is back. The stock markets are pivoting, the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates, and experts are predicting another recession. How will your retirement weather the storm? Are your investments fortified? Do you have a consistent source of income? Financial Sense Wealth Management can help you answer these questions and plan for the unpredictable. We monitor the markets, interest rates, and the economy so you can focus on doing the things you enjoy most. contact Financial Sense Wealth Management at 888-486-3939. Start planning, stop worrying, and make the most of your retirement. Call 888-486-3939 today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Welcome back to The Big Picture. In this segment, we're going to talk about hedging your bets. Now, we're not talking about hedging your bets at the casino. In our last segment, we talked about all the things that could go right and all the things that could go wrong with the economy and the markets. Now, as an investor, this raises the question, how do you hedge your bets when future outcomes are unknown or maybe less certain? Well, we all know about the importance of hedging one's bets, the importance of diversification, not putting all of your eggs in one basket. So with all of today's market and economic uncertainty, where do you diversify? How do you hedge your bets? Especially when the outcome could be bullish and inflationary, but maybe it could be bearish and deflationary. Well, that's a topic we want to cover next.
You know, we've all heard about the current tragedies in Venezuela. In fact, there are two or three stories this week in the Wall Street Journal, one showing Venezuela's economy in graphs that were really startling. But Venezuela's economic collapse is probably one of the world's worst that we've seen in recent history. I mean, the declines in the economy are worse than what happened to the Soviet Union after its breakup, probably comparable at least to the collapse of Zimbabwe's economy in the late 1990s, and the suffering wreaked upon the economy and its citizenry when the ravages of socialism collapse, as we are seeing now in Venezuela, we've seen it in Argentina, we're seeing part of this in Turkey. Although Argentina and Turkey are probably less extreme than what we are now seeing unfold in Venezuela, which is hyperinflation. Now, when you hear about these stories, this stuff doesn't happen overnight. It's the cumulative effect of poor policy decisions, economic mismanagement, and the political turmoil that follows when politicians promise more than what they can actually pay for. And isn't that so true? I mean, here we are in a presidential election, and I'm calling this the lots of free stuff that other people pay for election. And so many wise men have often stated, whenever the government promises its voters something that is free, hold on to your wallets, as nothing comes free and is often the less fortunate that pay for it in the end. Now, I want to give you an example of what this looks like. And I don't think a lot of people, you know, we haven't heard stories. We've heard stories about, you know, Weimar Germany, the hyperinflation there, hyperinflation in Argentina and some of the South American countries, Zimbabwe in the 90s. But, you know, now we have Venezuela. Its economy peaked in 2012 at a little over $325 billion. Today, it has fallen below $100 billion. Now, the U.S. economy is $20 trillion. Imagine if the U.S. economy went from $20 trillion to about $6 trillion, what that would look like. Now, part of this is the result in drop in oil prices. When oil was back in 2012, prices of oil were at over $100 a barrel compared to where it is today at $60 a barrel. But it's also the drop in oil production due to mismanagement. Oil production in Venezuela has fallen from 3 million barrels a day to where it is today, less than 1 million barrels. But the problem is actually much worse. And let me give you an example. Imagine if you were living in a country like this. Consumer prices have risen more than 50% per month since November of 2017. Price inflation is accelerating this year, up 465% in the first 2 months of the year. The main culprit, the Central Bank of Venezuela, in the country is printing money to fund the gap in public funding deficits. And you've heard about some countries like Japan and possibly in the next 10 years, the U.S., where the debt-to-GDP ratio is over 250%. Well, the annual deficits in Venezuela are 35% of GDP. That gap is being funded, of course, by printing money. When you're not taking money in, your oil revenues are down, and you're running the printing presses, you've got hyperinflation. Food, non-alcoholic beverage inflation rose by 350% in just the month of January. And it's not just Venezuela. We're seeing high inflation in Argentina, Nicaragua, and Turkey. The Argentine peso is already down 10% against the dollar this year. They got, what, $50 billion worth of loans from the IMF. And what we're seeing here is the kind of risk that you see when governments overpromise and stifle their economies with socialistic policies. The result, in most cases, is economic tragedy, as we see throughout many South American economies today. And it's one reason you are seeing this huge migratory wave coming to the U.S. Most of these people, quite honestly, are looking for a better way of life and escape from the scourge of socialism and government control.
Well, it's interesting that you're bringing this up on the show today, because we've seen, just looking through a historic lens, many of the same things that have made a huge impact on economies that are now being proposed here, like free Medicare for all, free college. I've even heard about it mentioned $1,000 a month for most citizens. Also, you hear talk about...
By the way, I'm quitting my job.
Oh, you are? Okay, yeah. Well, then we'll write that in too. But also, higher minimum wage to guaranteed wage, government control over a vast segment of the economy, from energy to healthcare. But what is driving this thinking, given the fact that the national debt has already risen to over $22 trillion, and it looks to be rising by almost $1 trillion a year? And by the way, we're not even in a recession yet.
Yeah, they're saying if we do go into recession, we could see deficits in the neighborhood of 1.6 to 2 trillion, very much like we saw coming out of the recession in 2009. I think at one point, the biggest deficit, I'm trying to think if it was 2010 or 2011, it was 1.6 trillion. What's driving this, Chris? There's a new economic theory running down the halls of Congress and maybe even in the White House. It's called modern monetary policy. Now, that sounds modern. Wow, this sounds cool. This must be the latest thinking. But here's what it is. It states there is no limit to the amount of debt that can issue by a government as long as it's issued in its own currency. Well, Venezuela is issuing debt. It's doing that in its own currency. They got hyperinflation. So therefore, the government can promise the voters spend as much as it wants by simply issuing debt to pay for it. No household can run its budget this way, but somehow the guys in Washington somehow think they can do it. Tell that to the governments of Venezuela, Argentina, and Turkey, or moreover, to their citizens.
Well, now hold on a second here. So modern monetary policy, doesn't the word modern imply that it's new and improved?
Well, that's what they're saying. Hey, you know, well, some of the problems that we've seen are countries that borrow not in their own currency. Because when you borrow in a currency, let's say if you're Argentina, you're borrowing in dollars. Well, the Argentine peso is down 10% against the U.S. dollar this year. That means your debt gets even more expensive. So the theory is here, hey, you don't have to worry about this if you borrow the money and it's all in your own currency. Well, the question is, who pays for it? Well, if the Fed prints the money to pay for it, as they're doing in Venezuela, as they're doing in Argentina and other countries, well, you can see what the consequences are. So it's a tough position to be in.
So how do you hedge your bets when governments decide to pursue policies like this? I mean, it really seems like the U.S. is trying to go down this route. It's, you're hearing a lot about it in the news. It's picking up steam. And I note that every president beginning with George W. Bush has doubled the national debt. Every single one of them since George W. And it looks like the Trump administration could add an additional $10 trillion if he gets a second term.
You know, the best hedge against such risk is the same hedge that has worked throughout human history, which is precious metals, or what we call hard currencies. Unfortunately, today, there aren't very many hard currencies today, as most of them are fiat. I mean, I can remember in the 70s when the dollar was just being debased, we were printing money, and you had hard currencies like the Deutsche Mark. And so, you know, today, most currencies are fiat. Some are stronger than others, like the U.S. dollar. It was interesting because the Wall Street Journal did a story this week about Venezuela called Two Realities, People with Dollars and Those Without. Now, those in Venezuela that have access to dollars are making out okay. Those that have only the local currency, the bolivar, are suffering. Many stores, supermarkets, pharmacies only accept cash or dollars. Nearly, here's an interesting, nearly one quarter of the nation's population now only use the dollar for ordinary transactions from buying food to paying for services. What does that tell you when a foreign currency almost trumps the local currency?
Well, and I wanted to ask about that. How does one get access to dollars when the national currency is the bolivar? I mean, is it the black market? Or, I mean, how do they do that? Is it another means of obtaining dollars?
You know, it's mainly from family members living outside the country, mainly in the U.S. and other South American countries. Immigrants, now this will startle you. Immigrants are expected to send $4 billion to relatives back home this year. That's up from nearly $2 billion last year. The repatriation of dollars will surpass the country's $4.7 billion in oil revenues this year, according to the Wall Street Journal. Now, the dollarization of Venezuela's economy is widening income disparities, and it's creating basically two national realities. Those people, they have dollars where they're accepted, they inflate. In other words, if the local currency is going down and you own dollars, they go up. And by the way, that happened in Weimar, Germany, in the early 20s when the dollar was backed by gold. If you had dollars or gold in Weimar, Germany, you did okay. Well, if you have dollars in Venezuela, you're doing okay. Now, two-thirds of the remittances are basically women who are getting them from male relatives who live in Chile, Ecuador, Peru, Spain, and here in the U.S. And this is something, Chris, it's been a pattern we've seen play out throughout history when governments inflate. Those who have access to a hard currency or they own hard assets, which in the past has been precious metals, you make out okay because precious metals are a hedge, and which is another reason for making the case that every portfolio should have at least a small percentage in precious metals as insurance for either inflation or deflation as it holds its value in either scenario.
Well, I happen to know that you've taken a position in metals as well as for clients. Would you urge the same thing for your listeners?
You know, I'm a big believer in diversification, so having a small position in precious metals makes sense. But I would never go overboard, and this is the problem, and especially when we saw that run-up beginning in 2010 when the Fed announced QE Infinity. In the fall of that year, we saw gold prices go from the low teens all the way up to 1900. We saw silver go from 1718 all the way to 50. And what happened is everybody piled in. There were books coming out, gold 10,000. And so, you know, you never want to do that. And even when gold was going up in the last decade, when I had managers of gold portfolio funds, none of them ever said put more than 10% of your money in precious metals. And unfortunately, people loaded the boat because everybody was going to get rich. So, you know, I believe it should be part of a diversified portfolio depending on one's risk tolerance. But it has worked as a non-correlated hedge to financial assets in times of turmoil and trouble. And more importantly, when you start hearing more and more talk coming from both parties on modern monetary policy taking root in Washington, it's my belief after the next downturn, in particular the next decade, is interest on the debt and the government debt soars, we're going to see MMP get implemented in a major way, as the government simply will not be able to pay for all the expenditures without borrowing large amounts of money, which I believe the Fed will have no choice but to monetize by printing money, as we are now seeing in Venezuela.
Well, Jim, you know, there may have been I may have given you the wrong impression when I was talking about your relationship to metals. I was referring to your exposure to mercury as a child. So
I don't know. I'm trying to think where I would have gotten that. Well, I'm eating seafood maybe. So, okay.
That may be it. So as we bring this show to a close, Jim, coming up in the weeks ahead, what do you see on the horizon?
On the horizon, Chris, once again, it'll be corporate earnings because we're going to be ending the first quarter. And once again, the year-over-year comparisons are going to be a little tougher this first quarter because, you know, the tax cuts have already been implemented. That's what boosted earnings for pretty much most of last year. This year, the comparisons are going to be harder. And as we mentioned in the first segment, with the economy going from 4% down to 2.2% by the end of the year and maybe down to 1% in the first quarter, we're going to be watching what companies are saying. Is the slowdown both overseas and here in the U.S., is that impacting corporate earnings? Because we're going to need a catalyst to drive stock prices higher. You got to have something. You know, you might have a temporary bump if the trade deal gets resolved. That would help relieve some of the pressures overseas that we've seen, a weakening in Europe, in Japan, China. But it's really going to be earnings that are going to drive it, unless you would see interest rates go down. But here's the problem with interest rates going down. If interest rates keep heading down and inverting, it's not going to be as positive as it is in the past, because it'll be more worries about an economic slowdown than it will be, oh, this is just the Fed easing, making it easier for us to finance. So corporate earnings, we'll be here to talk about it, as I hope you will. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Prytower and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.